Blog Talk okay. Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
White identification, very important concept. I talked about this concept earlier this month. I thought it was very important. It was very useful in describing what I observe within the context of white supremacy. Very useful term, I think. You talk about this term extensively in your book, and I just want to read a quick portion and then get you to further explain the term white identification. In the book, it is written, white identification, that this is a white identified black person is a black person who views the world through a white perspective, even when it conflicts with his or her own self and group interests. A white identified black person pursues interests, activities, and relationships primarily because white people are associated with them, and often avoids or looks down on certain people, places, and things primarily because black people are associated with them. Here's some more thoughts on the term white identification.
Sure. For example, you know, I'm sure we've all met people like this, and maybe we've even been guilty of it ourselves. But, you know, some of the things that, for example, you might find some black people who are proud that they can't dance, you know, as though that makes them less stereotypically black. And so it's almost like you have a white traffic cop in your head directing your thoughts and your actions, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. I know that I went through that for quite a long period of my life, and I'm still fighting it because I grew up in a family where there was a lot of white identification. I mean, my family members were very nice people, but a lot of brainwashing went on. A lot of brainwashing was passed along. So I would have to say that it's almost like you get permission. You have to get permission from the white traffic cop in your head before you can like or do something. And underneath it all is self-hatred, because there's no way that you can look down on black people collectively and respect yourself. You know, if you're a black person, I don't care if you're black identified or not, when you look at black people, and I'll give you another example. You're walking, you're on a train, and some black young people come on, and they're noisy. You know, you automatically almost think, and I've noticed this reaction. You'll watch the people in the train. Automatically, there's a lot of negative tension. There's a lot of negativity. But when some white kids get on, same age group, dressed pretty much similarly, and they get on and they make noise, it's just kids just being kids. So it's like you're seeing the world through white eyes. And if you're seeing the world through white eyes as a black person, then you're going to be self-hating, because the white world says that black is ugly, black is inferior. I don't care what they try to tell you that they're saying. This is a black-hating culture. So to be white-identified typically means that you're condemning black people, and you're also condemning yourself, because how can you not condemn yourself? You're also condemning yourself, because how can you not condemn yourself?
Hi, Tina. So why do you want to be America's Next Top Model?
I think that there's just not enough Asian models out there. I feel that I can break down that barrier, and I think it's my responsibility.
You say that you're not the girl next door, you're wild. What do you mean by that?
If you're going to ask me to get down and shoot naked, I will do it. That's just how I am.
Well,
the thing is, like, my parents kind of have a thing with that, so I mean, I don't know if I would go against my parents or not.
Hey.
I'm not sure. I mean, I kind of believe more in the American culture more than my parents.
Oh.
I'm not into Asian guys.
Why not?
The thing is, they're a lot shorter than I am, which is something that I can't tolerate.
You've come so full circle from your initial statement.
But do you understand how you were a contradiction? First you were saying, I'm Asian, I'm strong, I'm Korean, and then you're saying, screw Korean boys, and I want a white boy.
I don't know what exactly happened, but I got confused, and I started contradicting myself because certain things just started coming out, and it didn't make it.
We are all programmed to be white identified. So I'm not picking on any non-white people. I'm guilty of this myself. I had Michael Corleone as my standard for counter-racism, clearly white identified. But in the book here, you talk about how I think it was Brother Polite. He was on the program a couple weeks back, and he said, the system of white supremacy is pretty much worldwide, like white people have home court advantage. Everything is set to their advantage everywhere in the world. And a part of this white identification, you write, it's in the book on page 135, that it's normal for the white collective to set standards that benefit their group and affirms their self-worth as white people collectively. Can you just kind of talk about how everything, entertainment, labor law, politics, all areas of people activity condition everyone to be white identified?
Well, when you control the images, when you control the standards and the values, when you control who gets what and how much they get, when you control everything that a person needs to sustain themselves, and you put a value on people as well, then, it's impossible not to be, I think it's impossible not to be white identified. Even amongst the so-called conscious black population, there's still a lot of skin colorism, there's still a lot of hairism, you know, so it's very difficult to grow up in a society where I was standing at the checkout line yesterday at the grocery store, and all around me on these magazine racks, I saw nothing but white people. I mean, there are a few black magazines, but a lot of times now the black magazines, if there's a female on the cover, she's made up to look as white as she possibly can. They lighten the black females now. I don't know if anybody's noticed, but if you look at any kind of print ad, or you look at a magazine, or you look at a TV show, or a poster or anything, all of the black women now are this light brown to white shade. And you know some of these sisters are dark skinned, or at least dark brown, at least brown skinned. So I'm stood there looking at the rack, and it struck me, and I said, my God, everything I'm looking at is about white people. You know, and the women all look alike. You know, the hair might be blonde, same kind of eyes, same kind of nose. And I'm just looking at this almost like this cookie-cutter type of beauty. And I said, no wonder people are so brainwashed. If you turn on the television, it's all about white people. Everywhere you go, it's about white people. They made some statement talking about the riots in Egypt. And one of the newscasters said that Alexander the Great discovered Egypt. And I said to myself, everything you hear and you see is about white people. It's about white people even have done something, even if they didn't do it.
You wish you could be white?
Yes, and I wish I could have dark parents.
You wish you could have dark parents?
I have dark parents.
Where?
So you don't like being brown?
No, brown sucks.
What about white? You want to be white?
Yeah.
Why do you want to be white? Because they're rich?
No,
because
white
is so sexy. Okay, Moors, we're back. I'm sorry for the little technical difficulties there, but we are back. And I want to know if you all could recognize the mental illness. It's prevalent throughout our neighborhoods, throughout the entire United States. I see it every single day. It is the most amazing phenomenon to me, and I've been in conversations with sisters and brothers, and they cannot understand why I'm no longer interested in communicating with them. I don't want to date them. It's very difficult for me because. The reason being is because I don't look at TV, and I spend the majority of my time putting information into my brain for my own culture, my own story. I have televisions in my home, but I don't see any images. I guess you can say, well, I'm strictly Afrocentric inside out, and I've been accused of. A lot of things that I didn't even know I was doing. I had some sisters accuse me of ignoring them, and I didn't mean any harm. It's just that I was busy doing what I was doing, and I didn't see them. But anyway, nevertheless, if you got any questions or comments in regards to this, if you think maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing, go ahead and raise your hand and let me know what you think about it. And I'll open up the line so that you can get in, okay? All right, so I'm going to go on to the our next segment. Let me make sure I got the right one first, because I want to exhaust this particular segment. Let's see.
Now remember, when you're presented to His Highness, be sure.
Wait for me. Isn't it lovely? Do you like it? Do you think it will do?
Mother, she can't.
She wouldn't be better.
Don't have her.
Girls, please. After all, we did.
And that makes me turn the TV off. That made me turn my eyes off when I was standing in line. I'm like, you know, this programming is just really overwhelming. But I would have to say that that is the white perspective. Everything that's considered normal, from a Band-Aid. I remember being little, and the Band-Aids were flesh, you know, they came out with the flesh-colored Band-Aids. So I put it against my skin, and I'm like, this doesn't, you know, I don't remember what thought I had. Until I was older. But I remember being bothered by it when I was older and I had to get my own shopping, and I'm looking at these Band-Aids and flesh-colored, you know, invisible on your skin. And I'm like, do I not exist? I mean, maybe I shouldn't be buying Band-Aids. Maybe I should just get a rag. Because you're telling me that this is the color of flesh, but I'm not that color. So what does that make me? What does that do to a little black child who gets a Band-Aid and is flesh-colored, and that's not the color of their flesh. So does that mean they're not human?
What would you rather have? If you had the choice, what would you have? Would you have black hair or blonde hair?
Blonde hair.
And then what would you rather have? Black eyes or blue eyes?
Blue eyes.
So it's just a constant assault. Psychological warfare is what it is. And it is so intensive and so relentless and so systemic that I don't even think white people notice it half the time. Unless, of course, you bring it up. And they know what you're talking about, whether they deny it or not. But it's that's what I would consider the white perspective. It's everything that you're exposed to that says white is normal. Not white is not normal.
You live in a world as we do, where in front of the television and you see a TV show, and the crack dealer is always a black guy, and the judge is always a white person, and
or if the only time you ever see a black man is on the evening news and he's being arrested. Yeah.
Those images start to matter. They start to change the way the software in your head works. And that's
regardless of what race you are.
So I mean, my mother, who is black, sees the same images in the world, positive images of white people and negative images of black people, as a white person does.
Mm-hmm.
She can't escape that reality.
Wow. Again, context of white supremacy. And I would just throw in, I think white people would notice if it changed. If you went to church and white Jesus looked like John Amos from Good Times, white people would notice immediately. If those flesh coloring days, if you could buy one and Dick Gregory could put it on and it would be invisible, white people would be upset immediately. I guess I need to go for younger generation. So if Lil Wayne could put it on and it would be invisible, the Band-Aid, white people would be furious.
Yes, indeed.
Furious.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that, you know, when you talk to black people and you say, well, you know, you mentioned the color of Jesus and that, and they'll say something, sometimes a name like, well, what difference does it make what color Jesus is? And I said, well, you go into a white church and say that. You go into a white church and bring a black Jesus and see what happens. They respect themselves enough to at least want to worship somebody that represents who they are and what they look like. So you go into a white church and try to bring a black Jesus and see if they'll tell you it doesn't make a difference.
Home field advantage. It's the equivalent of if the Lakers and Celtics are playing basketball, it would be the equivalent of going to Boston wearing a Lakers jersey. I mean, it's home court. It's just not supposed to happen. This is white supremacy. White is supposed to dominate at all times. You talked about the psychological ramifications of this. On page 137, white identified black people. These people are psychologically suicidal. And you write, by viewing the world through white eyes, white identified blacks are in the unenviable position of embracing their own inferiority and abnormality and have no choice but to be anti-black, anti-self. If the white identified black is observed interacting with whites or blacks, he or she will eventually reveal their own racial bias and inferiority complex by the things they say or do. The confusion comes from trying to straddle the precarious line between the black world and the white world by serving two opposing masters at the same time, white supremacy and black normalcy. It is unnatural and perverted for a race of people to adopt a perspective and a set of standards that does not benefit their group and defines their own normalcy and self-worth as members of that group. Unfortunately, this kind of distorted thinking is exactly what has led to the personality disorders and self-hatred issues that plague the black population. Could you expound on that, please?
Well, I can give you an example. I was in a grocery store one time, and this black lady was talking. She may have been in her 50s talking to this white lady. And I was just happening to be, you know, over here, and I was listening to what she was saying. And she was basically talking about those bad kids coming from the city. You know, the black lady was some of the bad kids coming from the city and how, you know, they not raised right and they, you know, blah, blah, blah. On and on, stereotyping these poor, you know, stereotyping black kids to this white woman. And I probably shouldn't have done that. And so I did inject myself into the conversation. And I asked her, you know, I said, well, you know, you're comparing a school system that's based on real estate taxes deliberately so that the black schools are inferior. So, of course, the black children are going to have an inferior education and not going to be prepared to come into your school system. And so the white lady, when I started talking about the way the taxes, you know, like, I don't know if it's that way in your state, but in our state, the property taxes supposedly fund the school, the quality of the schools. So if you come from a more affluent area, of course your property taxes are higher, i.e. your school system will be superior. So they deliberately fund it that way, and that's what I was telling her. When I said that, the white lady got this look on her face like, I don't want to be part of this conversation anymore, and she walked away. So I told the black lady, who was a little bit old, who was, you know, somewhat older than me, and I said, don't you understand that when you put black people down, when you're talking to a white person, that when you walk away, you're in that same boat. You haven't extricated yourself from that. You actually, they don't look at you and think, well, that's a good black person. You know, you're basically condemning yourself. And she, you know, she, surprisingly, she didn't get real mad at me or anything because I really was out of order. But she said, oh, no, when they see Ms. So-and-so, they don't think that way of me. So I don't know whether or not anything I said made any difference to her, but it's this whole idea of trying to separate ourselves. You know, I'm a better class of black. I'm a better black person, you know. And so this white, I've seen black people do it constantly, and I've done it myself, is say the things that you think will make white people take you out of the category of inferior blackness. But little do you know, white people aren't that stupid. They know that's what you're doing. They like you to do it. This is my opinion. They like you to do it because it reassures them that you are still holding them as the standard. So you're not even thinking about white supremacy overturning and overthrowing it. You're actually participating and in supporting it and endorsing it. So they like to see you do that, but they're well aware of what you're doing. You know, so, and they're not taking you out that category, even if they tell you something like, you know, why can't more black people be like you? They haven't taken you out that category because if they saw you as a full human being, you would not be in that stereotyped conversation. In other words, it wouldn't even occur to them to say that to you any more than they would say it to a white person. They wouldn't have a conversation with a white person and say, why can't more white people be like you? You know, so right then and there, when they make these statements to you, you know that you're being stereotyped, that you're already in that black boat. So I guess the whole thing that I would say about it is that it's very easy to fall into that trap of trying to separate yourself from the inferior black masses. But what the only thing that does really is teach you to secretly have more contempt for yourself. Because there's no way that you can separate yourself from the black masses. Education won't do it. Professor Gates found that out with his Harvard degree and teaching at Harvard. He was still treated like an ordinary you-know-what. When the deal went down and that white policeman decided he wanted to have a little fun, he wasn't the professor from Harvard anymore. He wasn't the professor who used to be married to a white woman. He wasn't the professor with all the degrees and all the accolades. He was just another black man. So it doesn't matter if you decide you're going to separate yourself. You're not going to be allowed to separate yourself. Whenever it's that time to remind you of what you are, they will gladly and willingly do it. So it's just a very, very psychologically dangerous position to be in. I'll just end on that. to try to separate yourself and create a false reality. It's very, very psychologically dangerous.
I guess I'm off. I'm in a dangerous category too. I nothing but me. And my story is all I know. That's the only perception that I have. I don't. We have a real serious problem when it comes to us, but especially it's very, very interesting. But anyway, if any of you disagree with what you just heard, go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll open up the line. If you have a new perspective, if you want to in your two cents worth about what you say, what it's like, what you see, what you have experienced. Go ahead and raise your hand if you open up the line with Gene, okay? We got all tight. While the Lord, I think we're going to have to go to the next one. Just let this thing go. This ain't coming all right. Let's see what we got here. Time he felt like he just kicked the guy, and his brothers, and you know, you can hear the brothers shouting and all across the block and around the street. But me personally, I don't understand that. I mean, I think it's because I don't have any eurocentrism on the brain. This guy here, you know. I mean, nobody done anything, you know what I mean? And then finally, another cop came up, and he jumped out of the car, and they picked this guy up off the ground and drug him over to the car and slammed him on the hood of the car and began to choke the guy, and I mean, just total brutalization. I mean, this guy... And keep in mind, this guy was handcuffed while all this was going on. And the brothers, and they said, man, you have to do bad like that, so. But to me, that's not limiting brothers' situation. You know, what solution to the problem? And firm believer that you replace any fear that you have with skill. And then there is no fear. And sometimes I look at the situation and I feel like maybe I might be the only brother standing out there with this type of thing, this type of behavior, because I spend a great deal of time liberating myself from any type of fear based on the skills that I have and constantly putting my story and my culture into my brain to I feel like I'm 100% Afrocentric. I don't have any Eurocentrism on the brain. I deal with converts and I deal with the little system and stuff that goes on this side of the United States, but as far as someone injuring a family member, because your family member, to me, I regard it as just like my arm or my leg or my chest or my head or anything like that. And I believe I even had this even as a child. I was this way. And so when I see certain things going on, I'd be like, wow, man, what are you guys doing? I mean, what are you talking about? What are you doing? Why are you doing any talking about anything? That's just me. I don't know. It's just something that I found quite amazing when I see the brothers doing these things. And I'm trying to figure out what you're doing. And they come to me and they say, well, you know, yeah, so-and-so. I seen this, that, and the other. And I started to do something, such a thing. And I said, okay. Well, what's up, you? Well, you know, sometimes you can... Yada yada. And I don't know. I guess I was cut out from a different type of cloth. I've told a story about my grandfather, how he would walk out the house in broad open daylight and put moonshine in the car. And he would have me out there, and I asked him, Granddaddy, you see the police down at the both ends of both sides of the street. Well, why you wait until this time of day to bring the moonshine out? God, don't you know they are watching you? And he would always tell me, he said, boy, if you know somebody watching you, the least you can do is give them something to see. And he would have me go in the house with him, and he'd come out with a 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun and a 44 and a box full of shells and bullets, tell me to put them on the seat, don't put them on the flow bowl, and he'd back out and head straight toward the police. And they would always back up and take off before he got to the corner. And they never stopped him, never pulled him over, never messed with him at all. And when he come home, he'd always have the money. And he's just that type of man. But what I witnessed today is something quite extraordinary. I don't know what to do with this kind of thing that I see today.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, and this might sound a little extreme and radical, but I have pretty much written off every black celebrity. If your name is a household name, I'm done. That doesn't mean that you're not a talented person. That doesn't mean that you're a terrible person. It just means my expectation level of you is zero. You are useless to me in the fight. So the fact that you've been allowed to become successful, I have written you off. I know that you probably are successful because you stand for nothing, and you're not going to stand up for anything. And at the worst, you're going to promote white supremacy. So I won't even get started. But as far as I can see, black celebrity worship is the death of black youth.
Wow. You have, you all have another portion in the book where you talk about the dangers of white identification, specifically for young non-white people, black people, to be young, white identified, and black ain't where it's at. Being white identified is extremely dangerous for naive young blacks. Because they lack life experience, they believe having white friends means they will not be as vulnerable to racism as less assimilated blacks. However, once they leave the nest of familiar surroundings and people, they are unprepared for the racism they will encounter socially or in the workplace with unfamiliar whites. After high school or college, young white-identified blacks often discover their white friends are dropping by the wayside. Of course, this is not always due to race, but race increases the likelihood that their white friendships will bite the dust. As whites make the transition into adulthood and compete for jobs, lovers, and peer approval, the lines separating black and white become more distinct. The peer pressure for whites to not be too friendly with blacks will come from a variety of sources, including their white neighbors, relatives, coworkers, employers, or even from their intimate partners. This may force some whites to realize their black friendships are more disposable than white peer approval. Unfortunately, the only one left in the dark, pun intended, is the white identified black who never saw it coming. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a real common scenario, and I've seen it happen quite a few times where a black person and a white person will be friends, say in high school, maybe even college. And that white person will get married, or they'll move into another area, or they'll go into their career, and that black person will find themselves pretty much eliminated from that person's life in any real way. I've seen the peer pressure. For example, on a previous job, any of the white employees that really became too friendly with the black employee, was kind of viewed with suspicion. And I've seen that happen. I've seen where you know a white person, and then they move to another city. Well, now they're around a different crowd, and they change towards you. I've had people tell me all kinds of stories, people that they thought were friends until that person's circumstances changed, and then they found that they really didn't have a friend.
I have a couple of white friends, I walk up to them speaking, and I'm like, hey, T. I'm like, hey, Hilda. I don't have a problem with them. They like me, I like them. But mostly, we talk, we speak, we don't hang with each other. I don't go to my white friend's house because I might not feel comfortable in there. Their parents might not accept me. I just can't go and sit on their couch. I gotta know that I gotta feel welcome. But they can come over my house if they want to. I think the problem's been separate all these years because a little racism, and some people, parents don't want the black and the white to come together. They still stuck on that stuff that happened back then. I thought one of my teachers loved all of us, black, both black and white. But it comes to the surface that she really don't want the prom to go on. She really don't want to see the prom happen. I never knew she would like that until the way her actions been showing this week and all last week. And before we come in here to talk to you, She always tell us we ain't got to say nothing we don't want to say. We ain't got to ask no question we don't want to ask. You know, and we know all that. Just we want to tell you our truth because it's too much of this racism going down in Charleston.
Okay.
My name is Carly Boone. I'm graduating on May 22nd at 8 o'clock at Brogdon Field. In Montgomery County, we don't have a school-sponsored prom. We have a private prom. It's always been segregated. There's always been two separate proms. It don't seem like a big deal around here. I mean, you know, it's just what we know and what our parents have done for so many years. In our school system, you know, it's not really about being racist or having, you know, all white friends or all black friends. We all hang out together. We're all in the same classes. We all eat lunch together at the same table. And, you know, it's not about what color you are. It's about your attitude and how you present yourself and how you take care of yourself. It's not if you're black or if you're white.
Yeah. So there's one story in particular that we tell in the book. It's called The Commentary. And it's called Our Children Are Watching. And it was basically a story about a segregated prom in the year, I believe, 2009. And these students, you know, they went, it was in the South, I think, in Georgia. It was a so-called integrated school, but it had a 38-year tradition of hosting two racially segregated proms. The black prom was open to all the students. The white prom, however, had strict rules that excluded the black students. And we're talking about the year 2009. And you want to talk about mass confusion. These black students, because they had come up through this white supremacy system and were taught by the system as well as their black parents that going to school with white people is something special. Now, make no mistake about it. When you insist that your children go to an integrated school, that they have to sit next to a white person to get a good education, you are basically programming them to believe in white supremacy. So the kids are very smart. They don't miss the subtlety of that lesson. You're saying that quality comes being around white people. Anything that's all black is not going to be of quality. So you got these students in this integrated school probably being made to feel that they're lucky to be there, and they think they have friends with these. They think they're friends with their white classmates. However, when it comes to the prom, the white classmates don't have a problem with a segregated prom. As a matter of fact, it's one of the statements that the one of the senior white girls said. It's really not about being racist or having white friends or black friends. Assisted one white female student. We all hang out together. We're all in the same classes. We all eat lunch together at the same table. It's not about what color you are. It's not about if you're black or white. Okay, that's all good and fine, but you have no problem with going to a prom that excludes black students, these same black students that you claim that you're friends with. So, and these students, they didn't have any, they don't have any resources to fall back on, no knowledgeable adults to pull their coat and tell them what's really going on. So in their confusion, they want to go, you know, they feel hurt. And it was really, really, really sad is on the evening of the white prom, which was held the night before the black prom, another white supremacy move, the white prom comes before the black prom, a small group of black male and female students stood outside the white prom to applaud and snap photos as their white classmates strutted into the building. Now, here it is. You've got these black students standing outside a building that they're not allowed to enter because their friends are going inside, and they're taking pictures. Yet and still, when the black prom comes, I'm sure their white friends weren't standing outside taking pictures of them. So this is a kind of madness and psychological insanity that black young people are being subjected to. And You know, they're very hurt by that. They're hurt by the exclusion. But the thing I found that was interesting was one of the mothers who, one of the mothers of the one of the daughters who was going to the prom, the black mothers, she said that she attended a segregated prom 3 decades ago. And she said, it's hard to see my girl in the same situation I was in 30 years ago. So the point is that if you... Oh, my goodness. It's just really amazing. You know, I mean, I'm just, you know, thinking that you have, thinking that these white students are your friends. But there's one thing that, you know, the point that we try to make is right here, we have not taught our children what a true friend is not. A true friend is not anyone who condones your mistreatment. A true friend is not anyone who condones, oh, here, I'm sorry, I misread it. Anyone who condones your mistreatment is not your friend. Anyone who condones your mistreatment should never be your friend. Anyone who condones your mistreatment cannot be trusted. By accepting their bad behavior, you are teaching others to mistreat you. So the thing is that these same students who think that these white students are their friends, I guarantee you, they'll be looking back 30 years from now saying the same thing that that mother said of that girl, basically that nothing had changed. And that by the time these students have to compete for a lover, for a spouse, for a job, for status, those black friends will now be their, will now be the people that they have to continue to mistreat to, in order to maintain their white privileges. So we've got to do a better job of training our children, and the best way to start is we got to start getting real with ourselves. Back in the when my sister was, I guess, in her in college days, they had the flower power generation, you know, the love-in, the hippies. And everybody thought then that this was a new white generation and that, you know, they were going to be different than their parents. But guess what? When those hippies started cutting the hair off and shaving their faces and having to go get a job, you found that you were dealing with the same kind of racism that your parents were dealing with. So I guess the point I'm making is that when a person's really young, and obviously we're not training our kids in the realities of the world. We're just not doing it. They're coming out into the world, and they're getting their head bumped the same way we got our heads bumped. And if they don't do a better job with their children are going to get their heads bumped the same way they got their heads bumped. So that's why, you know, the idea of being white-identified and young is so dangerous. Because for some people, they bounce back, you know, they get bruised up and they bounce back. But some of our black youth are not gonna bounce back. They're gonna be devastated by the reality that they're gonna face coming into the world, thinking that they're gonna be accepted as equals because they have white friends, and it's just not true.
Have you, by the way, you ever experienced racism?
Of course. I think, you know, it's definitely something it's here, but I think it's getting a lot better. And I always try to focus on the positive and the progress that we've made. And there's so many people that have sacrificed and have gone through so much for us. And now we don't have to experience it as much. And I almost, you know, I believe that slowly we hopefully in a couple of years we'll all be all mixed up and it won't exist.
Yeah, wouldn't that be wonderful?
It would be wonderful.
We're going to
Okay, that's amazing. I guess most of us have experienced this one way or another, but I wanted to bring this out because this is a very, very, very subtle form of mental illness, especially the situation about the students at the prom. I find that quite extraordinary, quite amazing. But let's just keep bringing it out. We lay all these cards on the table and get it all out right now. So that way, nobody will have an excuse for continuing to have this mental illness. And I'll come back up and give us the solution. solution to get rid of it. Again, in a moment, if y'all would just hold tight. Now, we're going to deal with our final segment here when it comes in about the mental illness, and so that we can go ahead and conclude this and go into the second phase of the broadcast involving the police brutality. And keep in mind that we're offering our free articles as usual, the 14th Amendment Exposed, Commerce Game, How to Play, as well as Secrets of America. And the way to access that is just hit me up at thehawker53@hotmail.com. Just send that email and just get out and give me those free articles you mentioned. I'll go ahead and rush that right on to you. And to access my archives, just simply go to thehawkerarchives.org. But as soon as you do and you get that completed, give me a call so that we can get in there and go to work. Okay? Don't hesitate. Just go ahead and take care of that. Now, for those of you who like to work with your government, go to www.morrisamericangov.org. And you can register with your own government right there and dial into the national conference calls that are held 7 days a week, Eastern Standard Time at 7:30 p.m. And let me, the number to call in on that national conference call. Let's see, you know, we got it. Oh, here it is, right here, 760-569-7100. And the access code is 437-966. And then you press the pound key, and you are in there. And that's held 7 days a week, starting at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
According to the code, this is what I do. I assume that the white person, if he or she is able to be a racist, is one. That's an automatic assumption. If they are able to be one, then the person probably is one. But I'm not going to tell them that they are racist, because that would be name-calling. But I will say that I suspect they could be one. And I'll tell any white person that who's able to be one. I mean, even white people that have been around for years, maybe, had conversations with and everything, probably visited their house. But if they would ask me directly, do I think that they're racist, I say, you probably are one. That's the way I see you. Because it's dangerous to think otherwise. Somebody's got to be a racist. And the chief weapon of a racist is deception. So a white person can fool you for years. They could be a racist, but you not know it, or you don't believe it, on account of all the nice things that they do. But the person can still be a racist. Using a Pocahontas analysis, the white people, presumably, who were around Pocahontas, were racist in historical perspective. But she didn't think so, because they were so nice to her. But the racists know how to be nice when it's to their advantage. They were nice to her so that they could take over her whole tribe. And that is still the technique that the racists use. And I tell white people that. I tell them that's why I always have to figure that they are racist until they prove otherwise. Now, how does a white person under the system of white supremacy prove that he or she is not a racist? There is no way to do it until the end of white supremacy. That's the criteria. And you tell them that. That's what I mean by having your words in place. When they ask that question, well, how can I prove that I'm not a racist? You say, Brian or Sheila, you can't. You can only prove it when racism no longer exists. So if you want to bring about the proof that you are not a racist, you have to get busy and see to it that racism no longer exists nowhere on the planet. Because that is the criteria, and there is no other. Up until then, you are on the racist suspect list. Suspected by whom? By me, Why me? Because I'm a victim. And as a victim, I have the duty to suspect whoever I want to suspect, who is white, as being a racist. That's what I mean by the United Independent Compensatory Code feature. The United Independent future, feature of the code. So you don't have to ask another black person or somebody else, is such and such a white person a racist? You make that determination yourself. You owe that to yourself. And nobody's supposed to be able to take it away from you. I don't care if everybody stands up and says that Mr. Jones is not a racist. If you think that he's a racist, then he remains on the list. And you tell him that. And he might say, well, none of the other black people think that I'm a racist. Say, that's just speaking for themselves. This is me. I'm a victim of racism, so I determine whether I think that you are one or not. And if I think that you may be one, you stay on that list until I change my determination, regardless of what anybody in the world does. That's the kind of code that we need, that we don't have. And I'm trying to bring it into being.
White friends, Tater Pie, she was listening, and she said that she recalls a lecture Neely Fuller Jr. did, where he talked about how it baffles him every time he hears a black person say, my white friend. Just those two words in the same sentence is almost unfathomable. At any rate, before we move away, I hope people have a better understanding of white identification. I think it's a fantastic term, concept to explain what is happening in a system dominated by white supremacy. If you could take 60 seconds and think of the best movie that you can think of, just right now, best film you can think of that illustrates white identification. And to give you more time to think, the film that I think best does this out of the films that I've seen would be, man, actually I got a curveball. The film that I would say might would be any film that Lee Daniels did. I guess I would have to go Monsters Ball, given what Frank Wilderson said on the program yesterday. That was incredible. I sound clipped it. If the sound clip wasn't so long, I would play it again, but he basically said that film, Monsters Ball, two white people wrote that film and tried to get it made, and it failed 5 times because at the end of the movie, Halle Berry finds out that this white man killed her husband. She gets a gun, and she blows his brains out. Film was not produced. White people would not make the film when that was the ending. Black male Lee Daniels, who also gay, I believe, comes in and changes the ending, takes the gun out. It ends with them eating ice cream, chocolate ice cream, on the porch, her being confused. Film gets made, Academy Award, the rest is history. I would say that is probably the best example of white identification. I think that far and away trumps anything else, and the film is white identification too, so I would say that far and away trumps anything else. The film I was thinking of at first, which is pretty good but not that good, is American History X, and I was going to say, if you watch that one, just the people who are getting help are always white people. Non-white people are not getting help. Even non-white people are pitching in to help white people. The film ends with, and this is supposed to be a movie about white supremacy, the film ends with you identifying with white people. It ends with you being so sad because this white man has been killed by a black person. That's how this film ends. That's supposed to be a commentary on racism. Pretty good example. And the scene when they are in greater confinement, where the black male, he's helping this white, again, they have a black male helping a white man not be mistreated by explicit white supremacists. That happens in this film. A black man, black male, excuse me, is able to stop a white person from being harmed by racist white supremacists, like skinhead racists, in greater confinement. Incredible. Those are my two. Do you have an example of white identification in film?
Wow, you know, that's a I just thought about the movie that you just mentioned. Because I saw the movie and actually thought it was a kind of an interesting movie.
Which one?
History X.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Whew, gosh, you know.
That does happen, though, right? The scene I'm talking where the black one, they're in prison.
Mm-hmm.
He works with the racists. He decides he's not going to roll with the white supremacists anymore. This is Ed Norton's character.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get him. They rape him. They sodomize him in the shower, and they're going to get him. And it's a black male who intervenes and keeps him safe so that the racists don't mistreat this white man. That happens in this film.
Right. I remember that. Yeah. And you were rooting for it, though. You
white
were proud of him for protecting the white guy.
And
I remember thinking that right on, brother. Wow.
And they're cracking jokes all the way. The black male is cracking jokes and helping white people. And they're folding sheets. They spend their time doing laundry together, folding sheets. I mean, incredible, incredible.
Wow. It's almost like sometimes you feel that it's almost like you're trying to hang on to your humanity. And I think that's the appeal of these movies. I can't speak for anybody else, but in terms of black people, it's almost like when you see the black person coming to the rescue of the white person, you almost breathe a sigh of relief, like, whew. We're actually human. We're proving that we're human. We're just people like you. And so it's kind of almost like a, man, because I have to admit, I felt pretty good about that movie. You know, and wow. As far as the movie is concerned, I can't think of one particular because there's so many, but I personally think almost any Morgan Freeman movie.
Ooh, Driving Miss Daisy. I was Driving Miss Daisy. Glory, that's a really good one. Glory.
And even the ones where he plays modern day characters, he's always assisting, rescuing, and befriending white people. And it's again the good black role, you know, that persona, that good black. In other words, you know, they're not really involved with black people. They never save, rescue, assist, or aid black people. They definitely never rescue any black women or children. They're always on the service of white. Actually, that seems to be the only positive role that a black male can play in a serious movie. Is he has to be about the business of assisting, rescuing, risking his life for white people. And so I would say any Morgan Freeman movie. Because he's constantly, consistently. You know, oh, The Green Mile is one I would think of. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I remember several months ago, they played that movie, no lie, every day for about 4 weeks. And I remember thinking, they're really going to make sure we get this message. So you want to talk about the ultimate sacrifice. You die for a little white girl, if I remember it correctly, who you didn't even do anything to. But you're okay with that. And at the end of the movie, you're a good black, but you're dead. But that's okay because you were willing to give up your life just to make white people feel good. So Green Mile would be my pick.
That's a good one, too. Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted racist, white supremacist. He was on the program this past weekend. He's the author of Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America. Very informed white man. He is an English.
Okay, Moles. Let's go to the next segment. Thank you.
this swoop, and this is real talk. I wanted to talk about black people following Christianity in America. Now, the main reason why most black people in America follow Christianity is because it was passed down to us from our slave masters. It was passed from one generation to the next generation. The Bible was actually used to justify slavery. And a lot of black people today don't even realize this. Now, most black people in Africa don't follow Christianity. Most black people in Africa follow Islam. And most black people in Europe also don't follow Christianity. The only black people in the world that follow Christianity at a high percentage are black people in America. This is why I try to encourage a lot of black people in America to start being more open-minded. Start thinking for yourself. Don't just believe what you were raised to believe. Don't just believe what you were taught to believe. I think Christianity is a form of brainwash. Just like any other religion, I think it divides people more than anything. People talk about race dividing people. Nothing in this world divides people more than religion. And I think people need to start being more open-minded to different beliefs. Black people in America are so brainwashed by Christianity to the point where you can't tell them any different. If you go up to the average black person in America and tell them you don't believe in Christianity, they look at you like something is wrong with you, like you're an alien from another planet because you don't believe in Christianity. You don't believe in this false religion. The reason why I stopped following Christianity, the reason why I stopped believing in Christianity, is because everything about the Bible contradicts itself. Everything in the Bible has been proven false. The Bible is not the word of God. It's the word of man. People wrote the Bible. God did not write the Bible. So when I see people go on and on about this being the word of God, I just think that's completely ridiculous. It's not logical. And this is the problem I have with a lot of religious people. They don't look at anything in a logical point of view. They don't look at anything in a common sense point of view. And I just wish more black people in America would start being more open-minded, start being more independent thinking. This last Easter, there was a family event in my family. And I went to that event. And everybody in the family was talking about Christianity and the Bible. And they wanted me to join in. And I told them I didn't want to join in because I don't believe in it. And everybody in the family got mad at me because I say I don't believe in Christianity. And this is the problem with most black people in America. Most black people in America are so brainwashed by Christianity to the point where you can't tell them any different. And if they hear a different point of view, they don't even want to hear it. They're not even open to having a different point of view. I'm not telling people to stop following Christianity. If that's what you want to believe, believe in. I just wish more black people in America would start being more open-minded. I think this is the reason why there's so much hatred towards other groups of people. Other groups of people that don't follow Christianity. And another thing that I find really interesting about a lot of people who call themselves Christian is because they don't practice what they preach. You'll see a person call themselves a Christian, and they'll walk around cussing like a storm. You'll see a person call themselves a Christian, and they'll go around sleeping with every Tom, Dick, and Harry. You got a lot of these women got kids with 5 and 6 different men, and they got the nerve to call themselves a Christian. While they're having baby out of wedlock after baby out of wedlock. I would have more respect for Christians if they actually practiced what they preached. Because it's actually rare to come across a Christian that actually practices what they preach.
that actually follows what they say they believe in. For me personally, I'm more of an agnostic thesis. I still believe in God, but I don't believe in these religions. I don't believe in these man-made religions. Because I believe religion divides people more than anything. And I think the one thing in this world that we need to do as people is we need to start coming together as a people. And religion just divides people. You look at worldwide, all these wars that are going on in the Middle East, that are going on in Africa, that are going on throughout the world, a lot of these wars are based on religious beliefs. And I think a lot of people, until people start being more open-minded, a lot of these wars and a lot of these killings is going to continue. Until people start being more open-minded to different people's beliefs, this chaos is going to continue. A lot of Christians try to portray atheists and agnostics as being these bad, evil people. They try to portray them as being devil worshipers when that's not true. If you look at countries like Japan, Japan has a large atheist population. Japan has one of the lowest murder rates out of any country in the world. They have less than 20 murders a year. America has more than 10,000 murders a year. So when I see a lot of Christians in America try to portray people who are not Christians in other countries as being these violent, evil people, not only is it hypocritical, it's also propaganda. I just wish people would do their own research, look at the facts of the matter, and come to your own conclusion. Stop believing the media stereotype that any person that doesn't believe in Christianity must be this violent, evil person, when that's not true. A lot of people have different opinions about this topic. Leave a comment, rate, and subscribe.
Well, what did y'all think about that one? Well, anyway, let's move on to some of this police brutality and see what's going on with that. See where we at with that. Oh, yeah. Now, it's year 2013. We know we had a few years ago, we had an upsurge in police shootings against people of color throughout the entire United States. Now it's 2013, so we want to see where we are. And if any of you got it, like we're having all kind of trouble here this evening. First, we lose all audio, and now plugs are loading very, very slowly. I don't think they want us to bring this information out tonight, y'all. But we're gonna get it out tonight. So we got to. We ain't got no choice but to get this in out. This gotta come out. We got to get this out here. This has got to be done. Okay. All right, let's try a little bit of this. Y'all just bear with me for a second. We'll be getting some audio here in just a second. Okay. Now.
Tonight, a demand for answers from the family of a man killed in a deadly police involved.
Two police officers have gone on trial in the U.S. accused of beating to death a homeless man as he cried out for help. It's the latest in a spate of police brutality cases. But as RT's Marina Portnaya reports, many in the U.S. feel justice is not being served.
February 2012,
shooting death of teenager Trevon Martin.
When Marley Graham was shot and killed inside his home.
Two unarmed African-American teenagers in two separate states succumbed to the same fate. In Florida, Trevon Martin was carrying candy when he was gunned down by Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman.
The Bronx teenager being pursued by police moments before he was killed.
In New York City, Romarley Graham was standing in his bathroom when he was shot in the chest by a plainclothes narcotics officer who forced himself into the home without a warrant. The 18-year-old was not in possession of a gun or drugs. And according to NYPD officials, the 30-year-old cop who pulled the trigger lacked the proper training to work in his assigned unit. 2 months have passed, and there have been no charges in connection with the killing.
It's the lack of training in these situations and a lack of respect for the communities that you're patrolling that allows an officer to sort of act in a unauthorized, undisciplined, outside the guidelines manner, which in essence is acting like a cowboy. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not in the Wild West.
The fatal police shooting of a 68-year-old ex-Marine.
Kenneth Chamberlain Sr. was the U.S. war veteran who fell victim to unnecessary deadly police force last November. The 68-year-old was tasered and shot by officers who responded to a false alarm from a medical alert pendant. Chamberlain reportedly instructed the officers to leave before they broke his door down. An investigation into his killing remains ongoing.
Too often, the police are putting themselves in situations where violence becomes a more likely outcome. And this is the result often of overly aggressive policing policies.
The exact number of Americans killed by overly aggressive policing remains unknown because the U.S. Department of Justice does not require police departments to report fatal shooting statistics. Meanwhile, the New York City Police Department, the world's largest, has refused to release internal reports on police shootings from 1996 through 2006.
Until you begin holding those officers accountable, until when they commit certain acts, they actually go to jail or they lose their pensions, you're going to have a resistance because they feel sometimes that they can commit these acts with impunity, meaning that they know that other than a few headaches or hiccups, nothing is really going to happen to them, which is why we bring cases and actions against the officers.
Persistent use of police tasers is also being blamed for the death of 500 people in the U.S. since 2001.
Turn around, put your hands.
According to Amnesty International, dozens of deaths can be traced to unnecessary force. Policies for taser use vary from state to state. Experts say it's time for Washington to create strict national guidelines to protect the public from police growing trigger happy with electric shock devices.
This would help clarify things both for police departments and also, frankly, would strengthen the hands of people who want to bring litigation against the police for civil rights violations, because it would show, it would provide a standard that they could use for challenging these local police practices.
Critics claim that justice is rarely served when those who kill turn out to be U.S. police officers, in many instances leaving the very people entrusted with enforcing the law well protected when they violate it. Marina Portnaya, RT, New York.
Okay. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what do you think about that?
Time for tonight's rewrite.
This weekend, a few troublemakers turned a peaceful protest against Wall Street greed into a violent burst of chaos. The troublemakers carried pepper spray and guns and were wearing badges. Not doing anything. You heard the woman say that as the police were grabbing people for absolutely no reason, crushing them on the pavement and arresting them. We're not doing anything. We will post all of the video that we have on this protest on our blog, and you won't find anyone doing anything that is legal grounds for arrest. Let's take another look at that unprovoked police brutality. The reason that man is being assaulted by the police is because of what he has in his hand. He's holding a professional-grade video camera. Since the Rodney King beating was caught on an amateur video camera, American police officers have known video cameras are their worst enemies. They will do anything they can to stop you from legally videotaping how they handle their responsibility to serve and protect you. So this police commander has decided that the correct response to that man shooting video is to grab him and smash his head into a parked Volvo. The commanders are recognizable by their white shirts. The white shirts indicate a rank of lieutenant or above. Here's another courageous commander showing his men how to control the citizenry. His target for showing how tough he is was an unarmed woman who he had to reach across the police security line to grab. And there was at least one unprovoked use of pepper spray.
Pepper spray? Seriously? Pepper spray for what?
USLaw.com has posted a slow-motion version of the pepper spray incident, which, of course, shows there is no conceivable justification for the use of the pepper spray.
You know, it's not easy being a... You know, it's not easy being a police officer. Day in and day out, they risk their lives to protect us. But lately, some police officers have been seeing things. In Detroit, police killed a man who was holding the remote control to his VCR. The police said it appeared to be a gun. In Arkansas, a policeman shot a man who was holding a hair clip. The police thought the clip was a gun. In Chicago, a police officer shot a Southside woman who was carrying a spatula. You guessed it, he thought the cooking utensil was a gun. These days, it seems like when a police officer sees a black person, they see a monster. And every time he sees a black person holding something, he sees a gun. One night last year, four New York City police officers saw the same thing at the same exact moment. They shot and killed Amadou Diallo by firing 41 bullets because they all saw a gun in his hand. But once again, it wasn't a gun. This time, it was a wallet. A wallet? time to make the streets safe again.
Attention, attention. The New York City police have a difficult time distinguishing between a gun and a wallet. Please come and exchange your black wallets for this beautiful day glow orange wallet that no policeman will mistake for a gun. Step right up here with your black wallets. Black wallets out invisible so I can see them. Thank you. Day glow orange. Trade them in for day glow orange. Help out the police who don't know the difference. There you go. Thank you. Wallets right in here. That's right. Here we go.
How did I throw my wallet away?
There you go. Yeah, you got to throw your wallet away.
It's only a wallet.
Only a wallet.
Well, the wallets were a start, but there was still much work to be done. Thousands of African Americans were still walking the streets holding house keys.
See, that looks like a gun.
A bad idea, considering a cop in Florida shot Jerome Richardson after mistaking Richardson's keys for a gun.
If I get a little orange on it, you'll be okay, right? Thank you.
And don't forget candy bars. Perhaps people don't remember that a federal agent shot 17-year-old Andre Burgess after mistaking his Three Musketeers bar for a handgun.
You like Three Musketeers?
No, Snickers.
You like Snickers. Well, there was a guy killed with a Snickers, too.
Nutrageous is good, too.
Huh?
Nutrageous.
Nutrageous? No one has been killed yet with a Nutrageous in his hands. If you're going to eat Snickers, especially around here. All right, let's see how that looks. Oh, yeah.
Safety Orange only goes so far. My philosophy is you can never.
Okay. Now, we see the brutality, police shootings, and all this kind of stuff. But let's deal with some of the ways that some people have dealt with solutions to the problem. Let's look at some of the ways that people have dealt with these in an attempt to get a solution to the police brutality.
A Florida man hiding in an attic sparks a firefight with law enforcement, killing two officers and wounding a deputy U.S. Marshal. Authorities went to the home in St. Petersburg, Florida, trying to serve an arrest warrant. Police say more than 100 rounds were fired during the shootout. The suspect remains barricaded inside the house. At one point, a vehicle was used to punch a hole in a wall to get one of the officers out. A woman inside the house at the time is safe and with officers. Police say the man was wanted on aggravated battery charges. Lee Powell, The Associated Press.
A little bit before 7 o'clock this morning, we were assisting the U.S. Marshals Service in serving a search warrant on the individual that we believe resides at this house. There was a woman in the house with him. She informed us at the time that the suspect was there, that he was in the attic of the house. There was an effort made by the officers to extract him from the attic. There was an exchange of gunfire with the suspect. During that exchange, we had two St. Pete officers wounded, and we had a U.S. Marshal wounded. All of them have been evacuated from the scene and are currently at Bayfront Medical Center. Chief Harmon is going to go ahead and proceed to the hospital in the next few minutes, and he will give a briefing on the status of the officers there. Okay, that's really all the information I can give you right now. I know there's a lot of rumors going around at this point. All we're going to say at this point is the officers were transported, the St. Pete officers were transported to the hospital in critical condition. That's where they are at this point, and we'll have some additional information for you at about 11 o'clock there at the hospital.
The status of the gunman in the house?
At this point, we don't know what his status is. After the extraction of the last officer, we have not had any communications with him. As you know, our attack officers did fire rounds into the house in order to extract the officer. We don't know if the gunman was wounded or not. We don't know if he's just laying in wait. We're working very methodically at this point to try to ascertain his status. And as soon as we can do that, we'll give you additional information.
We heard something like that.
She was crying. She had tears coming down her face. She was bright red.
The Orange County Sheriff's Office demonstrated what it's like to be tased. They say they can tase children if they pose a threat, but it also depends on their size.
The policy reads that, yes, you can tase a student if they are aggressive and also if they're fighting the officer.
Standing out in the crowd in a red blazer, black skirt, and heels, attorney Elizabeth Ritter received some media coverage 3 years ago at a free trade protest when she was shot with rubber bullets in the back and a leg. Her beef wasn't with the trade summit, but with a strong police presence. Minutes later, she took another rubber bullet on her forehead as she crouched behind her homemade sign that read, "Fear Totalitarianism."
Don't get around me. Let them see it.
Hit her in the face!
Now her case is back in the news because of this.
The good news about being able to watch you guys live on TV is that lady with the red dress.
A police video shot after the shooting incident, just released following a review of excessive force complaints at the protest.
I don't know who got her, but when it went through the sun, it hit her smack dab in the middle of the head.
I'm getting to my camera.
Don't touch my camera.
Some very chilling video played out in court today showing the final moments of a young man's life in Pensacola. The inquest into the death of Victor Steen has begun. Our Christina Leavenworth was in court all day today. She joins us live from the scene of the accident via Skype. Christina?
Good evening, Lenny. This is where 17-year-old Victor Steen was run over and killed by a police cruiser last October. Now stuffed animals like this one are here in his memory, but it didn't happen here in this parking lot that night.
Stop the fight now.
The whole thing was caught on dash cam video. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement says Officer Gerald Ard was on patrol and noticed Steen on a bicycle. Police say Ard tried to stop Steen because he seemed suspicious.
Stop the bike!
When Steen wouldn't stop, Ard continued to chase him, and then the officer used his taser.
Off the bike!
Moments later, Steen falls, and the police cruiser hits him, something we will not show.
211 headquarters, I need supervisor EMS now.
The video, I think, is the star witness in this inquest. You know, it tells exactly what happened that night.
The judge questioned witnesses about the light in the area and whether Steen fell off the bike or if he placed it down. All this will help him decide whether the officer should face criminal charges.
New tonight, a family is suing after Orange County deputies fired more than 100 shots to stop just one suspect. It all happened back in January. Tory Breedlove was shot and killed after deputies say he was trying to escape from them while at the Alta Westgate apartment. Breedlove's family says deputies abused their power and the policy needs to be changed. They say Tory Breedlove never should have been killed. Fox 35's Tracy Jason with the latest on that.
When you look at these pictures of 27-year-old Tory Breedlove's car, you can see why he did not survive. The Orange County Auto Trap Unit caught up with Breedlove here at the Alta Westgate Apartments the night of January 5th. They say they will arrest him for stealing a car. Breedlove has a history of theft, but no violent crimes. But deputies say that night he used his vehicle to ram them as he tried to escape, and they had no choice but to shoot.
None of us deserve to be shot at over 100 times. Regardless of what the crime, that's why we have a judicial system.
And that's why this big sister has hired attorney Natalie Jackson to sue the Orange County Sheriff's Office. Jackson says the information doesn't quite add up in her opinion.
This is the advantage that FDLE has on us, the state attorney,
and the sheriff's office. We don't know what happened. We don't have the officer's statement. We have part of the story. We know from residents what happened, and most of them were running for their lives.
The Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the sheriff's office are conducting their own investigations, so statements from officers haven't been released. But Jackson says these photos taken of the car Breedlove was driving show an excessive amount of bullet holes, but not the bumper damage you'd expect on a car that had been, quote, ramming patrol cars. That's the explanation for Breedlove's injuries given on this death certificate.
And the policy issue that needs to be addressed is whether or not you should use deadly force at all in a residential neighborhood, especially against an unarmed suspect.
In Florida, hundreds of students rallied at the University of Florida Tuesday over the shooting of an African graduate student by campus police. The student, Kofi Adu Brempong, has been hospitalized in critical condition after he was shot in the face by an officer in a raid on his home earlier this month. Police say they were called to the home after neighbors reported the student to be visibly distraught. According to police, Adu Brempong tried to attack officers with a knife and a metal rod, but supporters and family members have rejected the allegations and say the rod was actually a walking cane used by Adu Brempong as a result of a childhood bout with polio.
Can you imagine what it must have been like in Florida when an armed robbery suspect commandeered a car with a mom and her two children inside? The police fired more than 40 shots at the car, killing the suspect, but seriously injuring a two-year-old boy. It happened in Jacksonville, Florida, and NBC's Tan Trung is there tonight.
It was a bank robbery turned carjacking that ended in a hail of police gunfire. It began Friday afternoon when sheriff's officers say a man armed with a .357 Magnum walked into this Wachovia bank and robbed it. Vic Davenport witnessed the frantic scene.
I pulled up, I was walking up to the ATM, and a bunch of people come running out of the bank, screaming, "He's got a gun, he's robbing the bank."
After escaping the bank with an undetermined amount of cash, the suspect took off into this wooded area and eventually made his way into the parking lot of a Wendy's just down the street here. The sheriff says that's when the suspect turned his attention and his gun to a four-door sedan near the pickup window. Inside that car sat 35-year-old Joanne Cooper and her two-year-old son Daniel Crichton and her seven-year-old stepdaughter Alexis.
At this point, the pursuing officer heard the suspect yell, "I'm going to kill you."
Unclear if the gunman was threatening the driver or the police.
The gunman then overpowered the female driver, forcing her into the passenger seat.
As the suspect tried to drive away, five officers opened fire, unleashing 42 rounds. The suspect was killed, but the two-year-old in the car was also hit and critically wounded. His mother was shot in the foot. Cell phone video shows officers removing one of the children from the car. The boy's father questions whether the shooting was reckless, given that children were in the back seat.
Put on like a professionalism. It really looks on the surface like a wireless show.
Sheriff's policy says officers may fire at moving vehicles only as a last resort or if a life is threatened. The matter is now under investigation. Tan Trung, NBC News, Jacksonville, Florida.
Two-year-old Florida boy remains in critical condition this morning after being caught in the middle of a police shootout. CBS News correspondent Kelly Kobiella has the story.
The shooting played out near a busy Jacksonville strip mall Friday afternoon. An innocent mother and child became collateral damage when police went after a bank robber.
And I literally saw the police officer like run up to the guy shooting him.
The robber, wearing a ski mask, attacked two bank tellers, then ran to a nearby Wendy's restaurant and jumped into a car in the drive-thru. But what police did not know was that this was not a getaway car. 35-year-old...
Okay, Mose. Let's deal with another person that consider this.
Yes, police officers were shot and are deceased. One suspect was involved in the shooting. That suspect was shot and is deceased at this time. I cannot give you any names, ranks, or even gender of those involved out of respect for their families, as we're dealing with the notification of their families as we speak.
Today, our department is in mourning. This is a horrific day in my career as the police chief and for our community and for our police department. We lost two exceptionally fine officers today. My primary concern at this point is for the safety and the well-being of my officers, as well as the families of the deceased officers. We need to figure out a way to bring our department together and get through this.
A massive manhunt is underway in Tampa, Florida, after two police officers were gunned down on the job. Authorities say the shooting happened during a traffic stop.
Within seconds of approaching the vehicle, the suspect had the weapon out.
Authorities say the officers pulled over a car that was missing its tags. Minutes later, a witness called to say both officers were down. Both have since died.
I can just tell you that to have two Tampa police officers shot less than 1 year after losing Corporal Mike Roberts is just absolutely devastating. It's beyond words.
Police are looking for two people identified as 22-year-old Courtney Brantley and 24-year-old Dante Morris. Investigators say the male passenger is believed to be the shooter. He was wanted for a misdemeanor charge. Ed Donahue, The Associated Press.
Two police officers have gone on trial in the U.S. accused of beating to death a homeless man as he cried out for help. It's the latest in a spate of police brutality cases. But as RT's Marina Portnaya reports, many in the U.S. feel justice is not being served.
February 2012.
The shooting death of teenager Trevon Martin.
When Marley Graham was shot and killed inside his home.
Two unarmed African-American teenagers in two separate states succumbed to the same fate. In Florida, Trayvon Martin was carrying candy when he was gunned down by Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman.
The Bronx teenager being pursued by police moments before he was killed.
In New York City, Romarley Graham was standing in his bathroom when he was shot in the chest by a plainclothes narcotics officer who forced himself into the home without a warrant. The 18-year-old was not in possession of a gun or drugs. And according to NYPD officials, the 30-year-old cop who pulled the trigger lacked the proper training to work in his assigned unit. 2 months have passed and there have been no charges in connection with the killing.
It's the lack of training in these situations and a lack of respect for the communities that you're patrolling that allows an officer to sort of act in a unauthorized, undisciplined, outside the guidelines manner, which in essence is acting like a cowboy. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not in the Wild West.
The fatal police shooting of a 68-year-old ex-Marine.
Kenneth Chamberlain Sr. was the U.S. war veteran who fell victim to unnecessary deadly police force last November. The 68-year-old was tasered and shot by officers who responded to a false alarm from a medical alert pendant. Chamberlain reportedly instructed the officers to leave before they broke his door down. An investigation into his killing remains ongoing.
Too often, the police are putting themselves in situations where violence becomes a more likely outcome. And this is the result often of overly aggressive policing policies.
The exact number of Americans killed by overly aggressive policing remains.
Okay. Now, Moses, what's the thing? If a man kills your child, should you kill that man for killing your child? Anybody care to raise a hand on that one? And let me know what you think. Should a man who killed your child himself?
Why is it that mainstream television news outlets like ABC, CBS, NBC, and many other media giants seem to make it their patriotic obligation to highlight, focus on, report, and broadcast to the world the problems, issues, and so-called dysfunctional qualities of black people? The latest media mogul to expose the negative side of blacks is CNN. CNN created a special investigative report called Black in America. CNN, like many other mainstream media outlets throughout the years, has managed to air dirty black laundry on a consistent basis. One has to ask, what exactly is the media's motive? Why the compulsion and preoccupation with black problems? Why the obsession with singling out one particular group so often? Is black behavior examined so frequently in order to create sympathy or solicit dialogue? And what exactly is so special about these reports? Black in America was created under the guise of looking into the lives of black America 40 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. But if Dr. King was murdered during a climate of an extremely violent and racist white America, then shouldn't we be examining the state of white America? What are whites doing now, and how has their attitudes changed over the last 40 years? What did this latest Black in America address that was substantively new? What did it address that Tavis Smiley has not already addressed in his State of the Union forums held across the country? What did this special report reveal that Tony Brown of Tony Brown's Journal hasn't revealed over the past few decades? One thing we know for certain, CNN has the financial muscle to market its specials in ways that not many networks can. Should CNN be commended for placing black people's defects on center stage for all the world to see? Mainstream media seems to be inclined to place the spotlight on the same old usual suspects: single-family homes, homicides, unemployment, HIV, school dropouts, prison, drugs, gangs, etc. Just recently, America was introduced to a so-called secret. We all set out to exercise the power of thinking things into existence. It was called the Law of Attraction. The Law of Attraction craze swept across the country like nothing else we'd ever seen. The basic premise of the Law of Attraction is that which is likened unto itself is attracted. In other words, energy flows where attention goes. If that's the case, and seemingly every talk show across the nation had guests to confirm its importance and relevance, what happened? Where exactly is the Law of Attraction being applied? Why doesn't CNN and other news outlets apply this beautiful and wonderful principle? Perhaps there's no money in reporting positive things. Perhaps it is not psychologically advantageous for the dominant group to project positive images on behalf of the perceived subordinate group. Or, like the news adage states, if it bleeds, it reads. CNN and other news channels too often use the word news like an acronym which stands for Negroes Endangering White Society. When the airwaves are constantly bombarded with negative perceptions of a particular group of people, those caught up in the media frenzy, including the subject group, will expect that particular group to behave in the manner in which they're portrayed. The news media, through the promotion of negativity in Black America, reinforces global notions that there are inherent character deficiencies within the very cellular composition of black people. Of course, CNN is much too clever to entirely omit black positivistic images during a six-hour special, but the overall gist and theme of the report mostly had to do with what blacks are not doing right, an implication that blacks somehow have the societal monopoly on doing things wrong.
Even though Soledad O'Brien did the reporting, we must keep in mind she doesn't own the network and she works for the network. If Soledad O'Brien reported only the good things concerning Black America, many wonder if CNN would have even produced it. When you continue to showcase Black problems over long periods of time, you create perceptions, even within the Black psyche, that ultimately lead to racial complexes. There is not enough time to mention all of the infinitely positive aspects of Black people, the incredible love displayed within their communities, and their immeasurable influence on the world. If CNN would have directed their energy towards investigating the good and positive side of Black people, following the special, people may have thought, wow, Black people are really getting their act together. It would have attracted more good and positive things and possibly helped change the negative perceptions and stereotypes that mainstream media is responsible for creating in the first place. On the other hand, what if CNN would have reported primarily the negative qualities and characteristics of white people? Afterwards, people may have concluded that white people are really falling apart. Why? Because perception is stronger than reality. If Blacks and whites were two teams competing psychologically on American turf, thanks to the media, whites would have the home field advantage. But the problems and dysfunctional behavior of white America in general have attracted very little attention from mainstream media. White stereotypes, unlike Black stereotypes, are not consistently reinforced in the news. But let us now reverse the news media trend the world has grown accustomed to and provide equal negative exposure and fair negative distribution to another group in America. We'll call this special CNN, which stands for Caucasian Negative News, White in America. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Department of Health and Human Services, it is white children and not those of the urban ghetto who are most likely to use drugs. White students are more likely to use drugs and alcohol than minority students, and students at historically Black colleges have much lower rates of substance abuse than other students. In the last 20-some-odd years, school shootings have been a major phenomenon in America. But when one stops to examine the ethnicity of the perpetrators, the overwhelming majority have not been poor, fatherless, urban ghetto Black males, but middle-class white males with appetites for blood.
Okay, Mose, let's look at the cause.
Struggle and love, we need to tell everyone there is more than enough. Talk about working folks, war and peace, hungry for honesty, hope and relief, trying to stay alive until I die. I don't ask for guarantees, but I need high fidelity.
I want protection for our children. I don't want to have to fear that my 12-year-old son will be murdered just for being black. I want justice. I want the cops to do their job and not abuse their power. Serve and protect. That is their job, not murder. I want the cover-up to stop. There was no fourth man. And no more drinking on the job. I want accountability in the police department. Let them be held responsible for murder.
White on the trigger. It's a deafening sound. A faggot. Will hit the ground. A day in the night. The great machine, men in hoods of a white, parade in the streets, another mass trial,
Welcome to a special edition of the Battle for Progressive Media. I'm John Riley, today's host. Racism, the struggle for national liberation at home and abroad, and the struggle against patriarchy took U.S. society on a roller coaster ride in the 1960s. A century before, these struggles almost turned over the capitalist apple cart in the South, and for a few brief years, a radical democracy transformed the lives of black and white working people for the better during the Reconstruction period following the U.S. Civil War. Today, I'll be interviewing Chip Smith about his new book called The Cost of Privilege, Taking on the System of White Supremacy and Racism, published by Camino Press. We'll also be interviewing Juliette Uccelli, who contributed by researching for the book. Chip Smith is a longtime anti-racist activist, socialist, and was for 10 years a rank-and-file labor activist and union shop steward in the Philadelphia area. Chip received a Ph.D. in economics at Temple University in 1994. He helped found the Fayetteville Peace with Justice campaign that organized three marches on the anniversary of the Iraq War. The group builds opposition to the war among military personnel stationed at nearby Fort Bragg. Juliette Uccelli is a longtime public school social worker, school change organizer, and social justice activist. She was co-initiator of Italian Americans for Multicultural United States, a group that was founded in 1992 to oppose the glorification of Christopher Columbus, support the anti-quincentennial campaigns in many communities of color, and reclaim progressive aspects of Italian American history. She is based in New York City and is a member of Freedom Road Socialist Organization. Her published writings include reviews and articles such as You Don't Have to Be Non-European to Dislike Eurocentrism, and with Don Murphy, Race, Knowledge, and Pedagogy, a Black and White Teacher Dialogue. The existence of racism is in dispute. The right would have us believe that we live in a colorblind society. Many liberals believe that there may be vestiges of racism, but it's a problem that's largely solved and now is a problem of lack of initiative. Chip Smith, how do you respond to that?
The civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s brought awareness to a lot of people that hadn't realized it before, that there was racism in the United States. But there was a kind of a shift in the 1970s, and the right was able to convince people that the civil rights movement had taken care of all those issues. And so pretty much for the past two decades and a half, white people have believed that by and large the issue of racism has been taken care of. So it's ironic, within like a 10 or 15 year period, people went from not thinking there was any such thing as racism to thinking that now it's all been taken care of.
Many white people might say that things were bad 100 years ago during Jim Crow segregation, or even 50 years ago before the Civil Rights Movement. But now all of that is in the past. Things are different now. In support of this view are the images we see every day, people of color as sports figures, movie and TV stars, religious leaders, authors, and politicians. The reality, however, is that once you get past these mostly media-shaped public images, the lives that the majority of people live in the United States remain largely separate and unequal. There are benefits of being a white working-class person in the early 21st century U.S. You have less than half the chance of dying as an infant compared to an African-American. 5.7 deaths per 1,000 live births for whites versus 14 deaths for African-Americans. Young white males have one-fifth the chance of being under correctional supervision compared to African-Americans. 1 in 15 whites is under correctional supervision. That means in prison, on parole, or on probation, versus 1 in 3 African-Americans. You have less than half the chance of being unemployed, 4.8% for whites versus 10.9% for African-Americans.
The median family income for white people is about 40% higher than for African-Americans. $55,768 for the white median family versus $34,369 for the African-American median family and $34,272 for Latino family, the median family. The white median family has 10 times as much wealth, that's assets minus debts, compared to African-American family. So for a white median family, it's $106,400, that's the wealth they hold, versus $10,700 for African-American family. In addition to these, there are advantages in education, inheritance, employment, housing, health, and health care, and retirement.
Why do you think so many people think that racism has been solved?
The whole idea of having a colorblind society takes the question of white privilege and the downside of that privilege for people of color in the country off the table. And so as the quote that Juliet read says, the media helps project an image of advancement when the reality, which doesn't make it into most of the TV shows and the kind of water cooler conversations we have, doesn't reflect the reality of inequality in the country. And that, and then as a result of that, with this idea of the country being colorblind and everyone being equal, then it's not a question of having to do anything about racial inequality.
In The Cost of Privilege, taking on the system of white supremacy and racism, you examine the central role that the struggle against racism and white supremacy has had in progressive change in the United States. Chip, can you talk about why you wrote the book?
You have to have a little background for that, I think. Having been an activist for many years and being aware of the importance of racism in the social justice movement, but somewhat vague in my thinking like 30, 40 years ago when I started out, the book A House Divided, which came out in 1981, was important because it brought forward the importance of privilege on the white people's side in understanding the role of race in the United States. And that book was influential with me and with other friends of mine. And so when the year 2000 rolled around, and there was initiatives then and underway now as well to try to build a more influential left in the country by bringing together both organized socialists and people in the popular movements, the feeling was it was be important to, in the course of that effort, to bring, to present, to encourage discussion about the ideas that A House Divided laid out 20 years before. But that book is dated, and so the idea was, well, let's do an update of A House Divided. But we live in very different conditions now. I mean, that, in a sense, the House Divided was written after the upsurge of the 60s and 70s, and it was kind of a summation of that period. And now we've lived in a pretty much a right-wing, right-dominant kind of political atmosphere for 20-some years. People aren't aware of history. Like we said before, people feel the race, some 60% of white people feel pretty much that the issues around race have been taken care of. And so as we got into writing the book, it became a deeper project, trying to draw on history, try to be persuasive about a number of questions that even people on the left are not particularly on the left, because that's where efforts to bring people together are underway, are not in agreement on. And so we've take on a question of privilege, the existence of an oppressed black nation in the South, Chicano nation in the Southwest, and try to give historical depth to these so that they don't sound like issues that just kind of come out of nowhere, but come out of the history of struggle of people in the United States.
Chip, in the first chapter, you discuss the origin of the so-called white race and white supremacy, not in a biological sense, but in a political and cultural sense. What specifically do you mean by white supremacy, and what do you mean by the statement that the white race is socially constructed? Sometimes people think that when you talk about white supremacy, you're only talking about the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, the early days of colonial days in what became the United States, there really was no awareness of whiteness or white people. In fact, for the first 50 years and more, the plantations in the South were run by indentured white working class people from England. And the conditions they faced, as Lerone Bennett Jr. says, actually set the groundwork for the treatment of later treatment of slaves around whipping and branding and all kinds of horrendous treatment. And but the rebellion in 1676, Bacon's Rebellion, which united white and black indentured servants and free farmers, put a scare into the elite of that period. And as a result of that, the Lord Berkeley and the colonial elite decided to implement. They didn't sit down and, you know, hash it out in one meeting or something, but step by step implemented policies which benefited the white workers and enslaved black people and drove a wedge between them. And that's when the white race was created. In fact, legal documents of that period begin to use the term white around 1700, which had not been the case before that.
Okay. It also seems that there was like political considerations in the determination of these privileges. Wasn't there a fairly strong workers' movement emerging in England at the time that would have made enslaving whites politically untenable?
Well, my recollection is that a decisive event in that period of changeover was that for the first time the British had a source of slaves on the west coast of Africa, which had not been the case before. They'd pretty much just been pirates and had robbed the Dutch slave ships. But then they got a steady supply of slaves from the west coast of Africa, which then cheapened slaves compared to indentured servants. And in fact, in 1712, then the British received the asiento, which was basically the papal blessing to carry slaves from Africa to the Spanish colonies as well as to North America, so that availability of a cheaper source of African people to be enslaved in North America was a key factor in part of the, in terms of the switchover.
One of the important things about Bacon's Rebellion, which Chip mentioned, was that it was a united uprising of both black and Native American and whites working on the plantations. So it became clear that this was a big danger for the ruling elite. So they needed to cement a system in which they would separate the people who could potentially ally against them. And by winning the exploited white people to believe that they were part of a superior race, served that function.
The first half of the book deals with the white race, racism, national oppression, and the potential for building a socialist movement to challenge the system. You talk in the book about the oppressed nations of the Sun Belt, advancing the idea that there's a distinct African American and Chicano nation in addition to the indigenous nations. That Native Americans are composed of many nations is not a new idea to most white Americans. People who know a bit about history aren't surprised by the concept of a Chicano nation since the U.S. annexed half of Mexico in the War of 1848. But many have never thought of African Americans as a nation. Where did this concept arise, and why should progressive people learn more about it?
Well, I think there's two parts to answer that. One is the actual historic development of African Americans, and then the other is when did that idea of an oppressed nation kind of crystallize out and become part of discourse on the left. And a number of studies, Lerone Bennett Jr. again takes the developing sense of peoplehood among Africans back into the earliest days in the 1700s when people were set apart to work the land. And in the course of that, began to develop a distinct identity separate from their origins in Africa and separate from the dominant dominant culture. But then during the Civil War, you know, the turning point in the Civil War centered around black soldiers volunteering when the draft meant resistance among white working class people, particularly in New York, and then in the period after that, there were hopes, but during the Reconstruction period, that there could be the possibility of real equality within the country. But then, when the Reconstruction was defeated, different national sentiments came out among African people. Although, and one manifestation was in the different migration movements. Where people would migrate out of the South. There was an attempt in 1879 called the Exodusters to move out of the South using the imagery of the Exodus and resettle in Kansas and Oklahoma. And there were also emigration movements to Africa. During this period also, when as the country became increasingly moving toward the Jim Crow segregation period of the right around the turn of the century, different spokespeople for different sectors of the black community that came forward in this period from, say, 1880 into the early 20th century. Ida B. Wells was a journalist. Booker T. Washington was a spokesman for a sector of the business elite within the developing black economies in the South and in the different urban areas. W.E.B. Du Bois and Hubert Harrison were intellectuals who debated with and struggled with the left, with the Socialist Party. And then Cyril Briggs with the Communist Party when it got founded in the early 1920s to raise the importance of black workers and the and the central importance of organizing black workers. So in the course of this period, when the walls of segregation were being built by presidents like Woodrow Wilson, who extended segregation to the federal the whole federal office among federal office workers, During this period, then, people began to shape and develop their own social reality, their own sense of peoplehood, and also it corresponded to the time when the U.S. began to move beyond the borders, wage war against the Philippines for 3 years in the right around the year 1900, and so the Jim Crow. The Jim Crow period characterized both what was happening inside the United States, enforced by lynching and other forms of terror, and also characterized policy external to the country. And so as the U.S. became more of an imperialist power, in fact, even the mainstream textbooks call that period the era of imperialism, the commonality of peoples of oppressed people inside the United States and those oppressed outside the United States, as in the Philippines, became clearer, and the sense of people wanting to determine their future kind of on their own, being forced to do that because of the door having been shut during the Reconstruction period, came more to the fore. So that's the historic piece. Now the awareness of that was developed in the 1920s by the Communist Party of the United States, and that's a party which today few people know about. Few people know about the history of struggles in the 1920s and 30s and the important role that leftists played in organizing the workplaces throughout the country. And they developed
class person in the early 21st century U.S. You have less than half the chance of dying as an infant compared to an African American.
The white median family has 10 times as much wealth, that's assets minus debts, compared to African American family.
Young white males have one-fifth the chance of being under correctional supervision compared to African Americans.
There are advantages in education, inheritance, employment, housing, health and health care, and retirement. The median family income for white people is about 40% higher than for African Americans.
The lives that the majority of people live in the United States remain largely separate and unequal.
I want protection for our children. I don't want to have to fear that my 12-year-old son will be murdered just for being black. I want justice. I want the cops to do their job and not abuse their power. Serve and protect. That is their job, not murder. I want the cover-up to stop. There was no fourth man. And no more drinking on the job. I want accountability in the police department. Let them be held responsible for murder.
A little bit about the relationship of racism to capitalism?
Well, capitalism basically came about when Europeans went out and conquered many of the nations of the world that were darker-skinned peoples. They conquered them, they enslaved them and brought them thousands of miles away from their homeland, they stole their resources, they destroyed their native industries to be able to supplant them with their own industries, as when the British cut off the hands of the Indian handloom weavers because their textile industry wasn't yet developed enough to beat them by honest competition. So to justify this, there needed to be an ideology, and that ideology was that the peoples of color were less than human and only white people were fully human. And again, the concept of white people did not actually exist till the 1600s, the concept of Caucasians until the 1700s. These were new ideas that were brought about to justify the inequality and the horrible barbaric conquest that had been perpetrated. And in addition, this served the function of getting, as Chip was just explaining, a section of the exploited people in the European and, quote, white countries to identify with the ruling classes rather than with people of color who were also exploited. So it served in that sense to help destroy the opposition to the system.
Reconstruction was the period immediately following the U.S. Civil War, which resulted in great gains and ultimately great losses for African Americans. Its importance is largely ignored or misunderstood. Chip, can you give us an overview and talk about the key characteristics of that period?
Reconstruction was from 1865 to 1877, and then with kind of aftershocks that went all the way up to the year 1900. And particularly the 10-year period there, or 11-year period from 1865 to 1877, was a time of really revolutionary ferment. It went from, at first, President Johnson trying to reinstate the plantation ruling class in the South, together with Democratic. Back then, the Democrats were the pro-slavery party. Things have changed in 150 years. But he tried to build a coalition that would reinstate the plantation owners. But the grassroots opposition, the organizing, the ferment that that grew up from the newly freed slaves, and the organizing that people did, and the help to, along with supporters in the Union League in the North, and white working class people who had been won over to the struggle against slavery in the course of the Civil War, in the course of the old plantation ruling class coming to the fore. There were riots attacking black people in Memphis and in New Orleans. And then also during this period, there was a reign of terror against grassroots organizers among the black freed black people, so that night riders would be, there was also an institution of the black codes, which attempted to put black people back into the same labor conditions they had been in before, but this time not calling it slavery. The counter to this eventually resulted in congressional reconstruction, and with that, the overturning of the plantation owners in the South. They were removed from government. The federal troops were in a position to enforce new conditions in which black people had the right to vote, where black people were elected into office, particularly in the what they call the Black Belt states, running from South Carolina to Louisiana. But then, in time, the Republican Party, which was at heart a party controlled by, and eventually did become controlled by, the large industrial interests in the North, began to move away from supporting the democratic rights of the newly freed slaves, and instead, eventually by the mid-70s, was willing to make a compromise by which they held power as the president, but in doing so, they gave political power in the South across the board to the Democrats. And so from that point on, black people had to struggle on a much more limited basis to maintain some controls over the conditions in their lives. In North Carolina in the 1890s, there was a fusion effort that put Republicans in power, including black people in offices at the county level, as sheriffs and tax collectors and so on, which ultimately ended up being suppressed by the Wilmington riot in 1898, which has been in the news in recent years.
The labor movement in the U.S. excluded African Americans and women for many years. Can you talk about that exclusion and its impact on the ability of the movement to achieve its demands with regard to the American Federation of Labor and other organizations like the Knights of Labor, in terms of how these organizations dealt with the fundamental question of who to organize and how to organize?
Well, the first major labor organization after the Civil War was the National Labor Union, and they were exclusionary from the start, but there were, and then the colored National Labor Union began to take form in the late 1860s, and there was some movement toward a joint working together, but the racism of the white workers put a barrier to that. They wouldn't want, at a convention, the one of the organizers for the Union League, which was a pro-Reconstruction organization, wasn't allowed to be seated at the National Labor Union convention. And ultimately what happened there was the National Labor Union tried to connect with what a break off of the Republican Party called the Liberal Republicans, and they ran Horace Greeley in 1872 and lost badly. But the point of it is that they, the National Labor Union, the white workers there, opted more to try to build ties with the Republican business people than they were willing to connect with the freed slaves. And that pattern continued. Labor, by and large, identified with the Democratic Party, which was a white man's party, all during the latter part of the 1800s. Now, there were two trends within the labor movement then, and really continued for another 80 years, but they took the form of the Knights of Labor, which grew up in the 1870s, which organized on an industry-wide basis, versus craft unions, which would take a particularly skilled craft, like people who worked on on the railroads, or who were tool and die makers and other craft workers, and just organize that particular craft. And that's what that grouping is what formed the American Federation of Labor in the early 1880s. So that tension between an industrial base of organizing, where you bring everybody in an industry in, compared to the American Federation of Labor's focus on craft workers, was a tension that continued on into the 20th century. But the Knights of Labor had something of a hands-off attitude when it came to actual struggle at the workplaces. If workers would get together and contest with the owners, they'd come in behind them. But by and large, they discouraged that kind of like strike activity and so on. Meanwhile, the AFL did the right thing, and which is the American Federation of Labor, did the right thing in the 1880s by calling for a big mass strike on May Day of May 1st of 1886, from which May Day has originated. And meanwhile, the Knights of Labor was trying to keep arm's length from that. But the fact is, it was a very successful demonstration, but then that whole movement was crushed in the following years, first by a bomb being thrown by a provocateur, then the hanging of four anarchist leaders of the labor movement, and then what became later in the 1950s called red baiting, where the unions would go hunting for communists. Well, the counterpart back then was anarchists, and the Knights of Labor destroyed itself by rooting out anarchists who were actually rank and file leaders who had following. I mean, a particular example of that was in New Mexico with Chicano organizing there. And eventually the Knights of Labor became an out-and-out racist party calling for black people to be returned to Africa. Meanwhile, the AFL took hold because of the rise of the new industries, the robber barons, development of the kind of skilled trades that the AFL organized. It was able to sustain itself, but at the expense of having organizing was actually class-wide, including workers of color. So they had a barrier that excluded black people. They were reluctant to organize women until women walked out in the early early 20th century and organized themselves. And it was the first party, first working class organization that actually came out as being pro-capitalist and just argued for getting a piece of the pie was the kind of the slogan they went by.
Chinese immigrants were vilified and subject to deportation, doing a lot of agricultural work that is commonly associated with Mexican workers today. Following the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, growers recruited Japanese and Mexican immigrants and subcontractors who organized them to fill the gap left by the excluded Chinese workers. Can you talk a little bit about that situation and what lessons it has for us?
Well, probably the key struggle that that captures, I think, the some of the issues you're raising was in Oxnard, California, a strike of beet workers there, and the company that controlled the farms set up its own subcontracting mechanism, whereas before there would be subcontractors who would bring workers into and work the fields. And so the growers wanted to take those subcontractors out of the picture. So they set up their own subcontracting organization. As a result of that, the subcontractors were totally angered by this move, and they had ties with the workers who they brought to the job. And between them, Mexican and Japanese alike, they went on strike. And they were looking for support from the Los Angeles Central Labor Council, and eventually were able to win the strike and gain increase in wages and have the subcontracting go back to its former way of being organized. But then when the Japanese-Mexican Labor Association asked to become part of the American Federation of Labor, the head of it, Samuel Gompers, refused to allow them to come in unless the Japanese were excluded from the union, and the Mexican workers refused to go along with that, and stood by their coworkers who they struggled together with. Unfortunately, as a result of that, the other official AFL labor people would not line up and support the Japanese Mexican Labor Association. As a result, it was eventually became a non-factor in the relations between the workers and the owners in the fields.
In your book, The Cost of Privilege, you describe what you call the Sunbelt strategy, which calls for the left and progressive forces to put a lot of resources into organizing in the South and Southwest. Why there and not the North?
The main underpinning of this this strategic approach to where we feel the left should center its organizing work goes way back. It goes back to the Reconstruction period and the defeat of Reconstruction. It goes back to the organizing among tenant workers in the South in the 1930s. And it goes back to the failure of Operation Dixie after World War II to organize, to follow through on the organizing successes of the 1930s and during World War II. And then the upshot was the passage of the Taft-Hartley Bill in 1948 and the open shop that was part of that. And the right to work, which has undermined the ability of unions to represent all the workers in the workplace in the South based on a majority election. That lack of organizing of the workers in the South underlay the low wage levels of that area. It underlay the closing of plants in the north, heading to the south. And industry leaders kind of groped their way to a strategy of shutting down what became called the Rust Belt of the north, Midwest and north, and moving plants to the south and southwest. And that's also where the military has its bases. And so the center of the economy moved to the part of the country which was the least organized. It was also the part of the country that is the homeland of the historically the homeland of African Americans in the southwest of the Chicano people. If we are about transforming the system, if we are about national liberation, getting rid of white supremacy and racism, having working people be able to build a future in which they run, you know, democratically run the country. If we're about that kind of major transformation of the country, then it makes sense to base the organizing amongst the oppressed nations of the South and Southwest and build the kind of organization that's needed to take on industrial heartland that exists there now. I mean, so and then you look at the history of the civil rights movement, started in the South, and its impact broadly across the country shows that when organizing does take place there, it has a way of impacting the whole country. And so our feeling is that conscious folks who are committed to transforming the system should be thinking about moving to the South and Southwest and connecting up with the organizing that's going on there.
Four chapters of the book are dedicated to the topic of the patriarchy, which you define as the systematic limitation and control by men of women's sexuality, reproductive capability, labor, social roles, and political participation. How do you respond to those that question the validity of this focus on race and gender and say, doesn't all of this talk about race and identity politics divide people? Those on the right say it isn't an issue, and on the left, some say that class issues are what's central to the transformation of U.S. society. Can you talk about these different views?
I'm a member of a union, right? I'm a member of the United Federation of Teachers as a public school social worker. Now, my union has a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender caucus. It also has an African-American caucus, I think what they call a Hispanic caucus. Now, to me, and my union is not particularly any great model of democracy, but it at least formally recognizes that if you want to have a united organization of working people, it's very important that people get to express and get support for their other identities and oppressions in that organization. So, for example, I'm saying that even in a labor union situation, you strengthen the union if you acknowledge racial oppression and build solidarity between the whites and those who are racially oppressed. And just another example of that, I have a friend who's a transit worker. He's a very pale, redheaded Irish guy, actually. And there was a situation where an African-American transit worker was beaten by the police. There were protests organized about this by Al Sharpton and other members of the black community in New York City. My friend particularly focused on getting some of the transit workers and some of the white transit workers to come to this protest. And in that way, they would show their support. And this, rather than dividing the union by acknowledging that some people do face issues of racism or sexism, this actually strengthens it and I think enables the people with those special oppressions to see a union as a vehicle that advances their own interests and to see it as a place with other people who care about them. So that's just, I address that from the working class standpoint of how acknowledging race and gender strengthens a united movement rather than weakening it.
Can you talk about the contributions and shortcomings of second wave feminism and what it means for today?
The second wave feminism started just as I was getting into college, and it was a wonderful thing for me. I mean, just the idea that the personal is political, that intimate relationships should be subject to critique and scrutiny and public discussion and democratic norms, I mean, that was a very liberating thing. The repeal of the laws against abortion, the right to a safe, legal abortion, and that if you accidentally got pregnant, you didn't either have to have the kid or risk death at the age of 19. I mean, this is a very important achievement on the state-by-state level. The idea that housework should not be the exclusive burden of women, similarly, and there were huge gains in consciousness and practice that came out of this. Now, the main weakness was that the movement was principally white-led and white-dominated and middle and upper-class-led and dominated. And this meant that it didn't adequately address issues in lives of the majority of women. And just to give one example of that, I mentioned the right to abortion as an enormous victory for all women, which it definitely was. Yet women in certain communities, for example in Puerto Rico, were subject to another form of oppression through forced sterilization, as were women with mental disabilities and black women at different times in history. Now, the National Abortion Rights Action League didn't want to take on this issue of forced sterilization because they were afraid that it could limit the right to sterilization for women who actually did want that. I predominantly, one assumes, the white and middle-class women in their base. So that was a limitation. Now, there were small groups that attempted to go beyond this that I and friends of mine were in. There is a group called the Coalition for Abortion Rights and Against Sterilization Abuse. And this is a group of anti-imperialist women that tried to combine the issues, and in particular in solidarity with Puerto Rico, where there were huge abuses going on at that time and it was coming to light. But that trend was not the dominant one in the movement, and it very much fell into its white and middle class limitations.
One of the chapters that deals with the subject of patriarchy puts forth the concept of intersectionality. Julia, can you talk about that?
Intersectionality is the recognition that people in their lives live multiple forms of oppressions and resistance in their own life, and that the political implication of it is that in order to build stronger movements and united movements and movements that people can pour their passion into, that we need to recognize intersectionality in our organizing. And in a way, the example of the transit worker that I gave does address that. But I could think also of a struggle that I was involved in around a curriculum called the Children of the Rainbow, where the New York City Department of Education for once did a good thing and said put out this curriculum that mentioned a book called Heather Has Two Mommies, which said that people could have two mommies or two daddies or grandma, and it was all family. Well, the right wing started to use this as a wedge issue. And what they particularly did was to try to pit working class black and Latino people who were the parents in the public school system against gay people who they portrayed as white and all upper class and middle class. And this was very bitter. A friend of mine, a Jamaican American teacher, helped to start a response to this right wing wedge attack. And one of the things that he did was to bring out the voices of people who were working class and black and also gay or lesbian and have kids. And by recognizing this intersectionality of people's lives, you don't allow the right wing to pit people against each other so easily.
Chip and Juliet, you're both socialists, and the book talks about the need to bring about socialism. But the history of socialism has been checkered with great successes, but ultimately in most countries where it's been established, there's emerged a new class which has appropriated for itself the mantle of the people and created a new leadership class that got extra privileges. Is there a way that a socialist-oriented mass movement can ensure that that it and the socialist society it produces won't be co-opted and become a dictatorship?
I think there are certain things that we learn from the past. For example, just nationalizing property isn't enough to actually make the majority of the people who work really the masters of society, because you can have a class of bureaucrats who control the nationalized property. Just saying that women should work outside the home and women should have the right to, which was a great gain, especially in semi-feudal cultures, is not enough to liberate women. You need also to put out the idea that women don't have to do the double day, that also the work at home is something that men should share. But also, I think we learn that you can't trust that there's going to be one party which is all-knowing and has all wisdom contained and within it and knows what's best for everybody's liberation, so that you need actual autonomous organizations of women and black people and Dominican American people and Native Americans and other oppressed people actual free autonomous mass organizations for people to think through what we want our liberation to be, not for the all-knowing party to tell us.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, what do you think? It's been a very enlightening broadcast. And, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to bring this to a halt. And I hope you all have gotten something out of this thing. I've been your host, Takamana LB. And, so next time, y'all take it easy and good night.